Welcome to Take It From Us with host Kent Johns. Real people, real voices, real lives, discussing mental health, addiction, and disability in the community. Your weekly window to the real world. Welcome to Take It From Us.
Take It From Us for another week. I am your host, Kent Johns. Karen Murphy producing our program again, as she always does. Man, she's getting a bit wild and woolly out there. Anyone would think that it's winter, eh? Those beautiful autumnal days that we could sort of lean on and trust have basically disappeared, and now this is the slog. This can be a tough time for people. It really can. A lot of people struggle at this time of the year because the weather is so bad. I've made a decision to try and be brave through this time. You might recall about a month ago we had Jimmy Hunt on our program. He's a mental health advocate. He's done a lot of work over the years, was eligible for the New Zealander of the Year Award not so long ago. And he told us about the three C's. One, two, three. Constant, conscious, choice. And that really resonated with me. It landed well with me. Constant, conscious, choice. So if we want to look after ourselves, we have to be constantly doing it. It's not a fly-by-night approach. It's not something that we can just sort of dip in and out of. And I thought, you know what? This cold water therapy, he talks it up, and I've heard this from other people as well, I'm going to give it a go. So for the last, I guess, 3 weeks, every day, I have been immersing myself in cold water, whether it be at the beach or whether it be in the shower. I haven't braved myself to jump into that. I'm not really a bath sort of a guy. I can't see myself sitting in a cold bath. But a cold shower is okay. Jumping in the ocean is okay. I'm fortunate I live near the beach. And the science behind this is kind of quite easy to work out. It goes to something called hormesis. What doesn't kill us makes us stronger. So one example of this would be, say, weight training, where you push some weights, you do some dumbbell reps, your muscles get sore, they get fatigued, they feel weak, but over time they then start to strengthen. And then you can start to be able to adapt and do more work. Well, the same thing happens when it comes to our environment. If we were to jump in a sauna, or if we were to go and exercise in super hot conditions, we'd struggle to start with, but over time our body adapts and gets stronger. It's the same with the cold water therapy. Great for the brain. It's great to reduce the inflammation and the buildup of some of our neurotransmitters in our brain that we're not after, to just be better for it. And the sleep, man. Another guest that we had on the show a couple of weeks ago, Ed Timmings, he said, man, have you noticed the sleep? And it was a bit early on for me to actually say yes, but I can honestly say now, having been doing this for about 3 weeks, the sleep's been much, much, much better. Much better. So I think it's working. It's not always enjoyable. I had a swim last week at the beach and it was just way too windy and I really did not enjoy it. But there's something therapeutic about it. It's invigorating. It's cathartic. At times it feels perverse that I'm actually looking forward to jumping in the cold water in the middle of winter. But I just know the benefits are so great now. I'm starting to feel it. So on the days when I don't really want to be doing it, I say to myself, Kent, trust your experience. You know you will feel better for doing it. So just go ahead and do it. And the key part for me that I've learned is in the first sort of 2 minutes, when you're either in the shower or in the ocean, is to get your breathing right. Breathe through the nose, breathe slowly and surely and confidently. What that does is that it lowers the fight or flight response. So instead of the urge to run out, if I can manage my breathing, I can hang in there for just long enough to get the benefits from the cold water therapy. If you've had any luck with this yourself, let me know. My partner started to do it. She loves it. I've got some other friends as well who are looking to be brave. And it kind of made me think about being a kid, learning about the Polar Bears Club. Who are these crazy people going out for a swim in the middle of winter as a polar bear? Well, perhaps I'm a polar bear now. I just don't have many other polar bears that I knock around with. It's become kind of a solo exercise, but the benefits have been enormous. And as I say, the breathing is key. Speaking of breathing, on our program today, Dina Sinisa from the Breathe Clinic in Auckland is going to join us. Can we reduce our stress and anxiety and help depression through breathing? But these are really important questions. We'll answer those for us a little later. We haven't spoken to Sean Robinson, the Chief Executive of the Mental Health Foundation this year, and we thought it was about time we did. Health officials, as we know, have been saying we have a mental health crisis for children and young people looming, if it's in fact not here already. It might well already be here. And what are the lasting effects of COVID restrictions and the psychological trauma of feeling isolated? You know, COVID isn't going away soon, is it? And we know the damage that it's already done. The number of people in our country needing urgent help just continues to grow. Mind-boggling. Sean Robinson, thanks so much for your time on our program today. It's really good of you to join us. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad, Kent. Like everybody, had my ups and downs with the way the world is at the moment, but... Yeah, it was a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, look, there's a lot we could talk about, and I know this is your debut appearance on the program, so we thank you very much for it. There is so much that we could cover off. Specifically, we want to talk about young people very shortly. But just to start with today, can you tell us and our listeners what your own research has found in the last sort of 12 months or so about how people are dealing emotionally with what's been happening in their lives?
Yeah, well, look, we've been monitoring the sort of well-being of the population for about 18 months now. We didn't have the resources to do that, but a fantastic company called Ipsos has been low-bonoing research for us, and particularly in the context of COVID-19. So we have been using a internationally recognised measurement. And around about February 2021, it came back saying that about a quarter of all adults had dangerously low well-being scores. So this is not necessarily mentally unwell, but really struggling and in danger of slipping into sort of worse mental and emotional state, you know, quite vulnerable to drinking too much, you know, using other means to try and cope with those difficult thoughts and feelings. Well, about a year later, you know, after another year of COVID-19, it's up to 36%. So that's a pretty steep jump, and 25% was a disturbing figure. 36% is a very disturbing figure. And you have to put that in the context that since 2006, the measures of people who are, you know, actively in distress has been that it's about 20% of the adult population. So, you know, we are dealing with close to a million people in any 12-month period who are seriously in distress, and a significant number above that who are just really struggling now because of what's been going on.
Yeah, I mean, it's an epidemic for New Zealand, whichever way you look at it, and the numbers would bear that out. So 36% of us are experiencing poor emotional well-being, but I think you touched on maybe a phrase that we often use, which would be people who are languishing. That is, maybe they're kind of okay and they're up and they're down and they're using different ways to cope. That number would have to be well over and above 36, I would have thought.
Well, it's hard to say because I would say that at 36 is probably about right. There have been periodic studies on that done over the past few years, and they've tended to come in at around 30-33%. So, yeah, look, we're going to keep measuring this and see what happens. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's a lot of people, and it's a very big issue, and you know, it is the biggest health issue facing New Zealand next to COVID-19, and it impacts every part of people's lives. I mean, at those kinds of numbers, you know, there wouldn't be a whānau, a family in New Zealand that is not affected by somebody who is languishing or, you know, or actively having significant mental distress.
You've been in the job now for 6 years in your position. Was this day always coming, regardless of COVID, where we would look around and say, man, oh, man, oh, man, this, our emotional and mental well-being looks like it is starting to break in New Zealand?
Yeah, look, I think the day was already there the day I arrived 6 years ago. You know, I don't really think this is fundamentally new. As I say, that measure of the number of people who are, you know, might be diagnosed as having a mental illness, that comes from 2006. So, and that's, you know, 20% of the adult population and doesn't even count our under 18-year-olds, and we know we've got issues there. So I think in a way what it is it's not that the situation has been getting dramatically worse, although I'm sure it has been getting worse, but I think it's more that we are more willing to recognise it and people are more willing to say I'm struggling, and we're more willing to have the conversation about it. I think that the support services have been, what has been happening is that support services have been getting more and more and more overwhelmed, and, you know, therefore people have been getting angrier and more frustrated, and so mental health, you know, has become a significant political issue. So one of the things, about a year, you know, I arrived just before the 2007, about a year before the 2017 election, and mental health suddenly became a hot-button political issue. Now, I think the only reason it wasn't a hot-button political issue in 2020 was because COVID had overshadowed it. But when you know, are thinking about a million people a year who are significantly struggling and more than that who are languishing, then it's going to stay a political issue. I keep saying to politicians of every persuasion and, you know, leaders in different parts of government, you know, you ignore this issue at your peril, because the people of New Zealand, they are concerned about it. They're not ignoring it.
Well, I noticed too that the Health Minister, Andrew Little, said recently in an interview with Stuff, quote, creating a psychologist or clinical psychiatrist is a 7 to 10 year plan. Unquote. Is his numbers there right? He's kind of suggesting there we need to be patient, that it takes time, or is it a way of pushing the issue out a little bit where in actual fact they could be doing more now?
Well, look, I think he's right, but I think, you know, what the government did when they came in is they had the inquiry into mental health, right? So they got a bunch of experts from a variety of perspectives in New Zealand to have a look at the issues. Now, those experts, you know, that panel did not say rely entirely on training psychologists and counsellors and nurses, and that'll fix it. They said you have to do three things. You have to address the things that are causing a lot of the trauma, a lot of the stress, you know, a lot of the stuff that is the root causes of people's mental health issues. You know, and that can be things like housing. You know, if you're not living in warm, dry housing, that is going to just ramp up the stresses of every part of your life. If you don't have enough money, you know, if you have to work three jobs to feed your kids, if you, you know, are in a violent household, if you're experiencing racism and bullying, you know, all of these things, you don't have to be a rocket scientist, but there is a lot of science to show that these things, you know, really impact on people's mental health. So we have to get, you know, address those things. Now, that takes time. You know, those problems can't just be solved overnight. then yes, you do have to increase the amount of services. So, Kent, I live with bipolar disorder, and you know, I've been living with that as an official diagnosis for well over 20 years now. So, you know, I absolutely know the importance of good clinical treatment. You know, I'm on medications. I've had, you know, really good support at times. So it's absolutely vital. And we need more of it and more types of it and earlier support for it. So like many people, I didn't get support until I was very, very, very unwell. Now, some of that was me. I experienced the self-stigma and not wanting to admit that I had. But also, it wasn't the norm that you would be able to go to your GP and there'd be people there who could talk to you about your mental health. So, and even more so, you know, the people that really helped me to come to terms with this were actually friends. You know, it was the informal support. And yes, I got proper care from a psychologist and psychiatrist, but I was lucky to have friends who had the confidence and a bit of knowledge and could have conversations with me about it. So, you know, we need that sense of support needs to be much broader than just doctors and nurses and psychologists waiting till we're broken and fixing us. You know, we need peer support. We need support in the community. We need early support. There are so many parts of the support structure that, you know, I just have massive holes in them that, you know, my list could go on and on. But my point is, it's not just about the DHB services. It is about them, and it's about more than them. So, you know, number one, address the causes. Number two, definitely, you know, address the services and supports for people in a wide range of ways. The third one is, you know, to promote people's awareness, motivate them of how they can look after their own mental health and that of others. So for me, you know, I'll tell you, Kent, I'm, you know, two or three times a year I have bouts of depression. I'm actually just sort of teetering at the moment. I'm just, you know, just having not the best of few days. And for me, yes, my medications are vital in that situation, but also I double down on all the ways I look after myself. You know, I rang a mate today and had a chat and just told him how I was feeling, you know, and he just listened. He was great, you know. I get out in the sunshine. It's sunny in Tamaki Makaurau for a change for the last 10 days. So I've got out and went for a walk, you know. I'm making sure I sleep regularly. I eat well. I take a bit of time actually just looking at the, you know, the tree and the green zone between my place and the motorway and actually, you know, taking a little bit of time to be in the moment. You know, there are many, many ways that, you know, I strum my guitar. There are so many ways that you can do things that, you know, that help to boost your mental well-being. And if we promote those things, if we motivate those things amongst people in the community, we're kind of empowering ourselves to be able to support our own mental health. And it's not that any one of those three things will resolve the issues with mental health. It's all three of them working together. You know, we'll never fix the issues one person at a time, waiting until we've found all million people and get them to a psychiatrist or a psychologist. Even if we had the perfect society, we would still have people that develop issues with their mental health. And even if we were sort of all practicing really healthy lifestyles that boosted our mental well-being, we would still have, you know, times when people are struggling. But if we have all three of those things working together, then, you know, we'll be cooking with gas, basically. And so, yeah, that's, and some of those things can be done faster than others. You know, like during COVID, we have been given resources to help promote ways that people can boost their well-being during COVID. And, you know, that can happen quite quickly. You know, we've got another program called Farm Strong that's been going for a few years in the rural sector. Now, we've got 23% of all farmers saying their wellbeing's improved because they identify with Sam Whitelock and other farmers and they're, you know, talking about how they look after themselves, you know. So it starts to build this momentum in the community. So, yeah, I mean, I think what is frustrating is that having invested in getting that advice from the inquiry, the government then proceeded to ignore chunks of it or say they were going to do it. But, you know, what I haven't seen yet is a plan for how they're going to actually put those things in place. So, you know, what I say about what the government's done in mental health is everything that they have done is good. Everything they have done is positive. They're just not doing enough and they're not being systematic about it.
Sean Robinson is with us on Take It From Us. He's the Chief Executive of the Mental Health Foundation. And look, Sean, really appreciate you being so candid too about your own mental well-being and having a chat to us about that. You know, so good for you. I wanted to ask you too specifically about how the youth of New Zealand are travelling. And I noticed recently that the Chair of the New Zealand's Faculty of Child Psychiatry, Dr. Tanya Wright, said that every child and adolescent mental health service in the country by at least 25%, and that would be an average number right across all of the DHBs in New Zealand. Now, that's a worryingly high number again. What's going on there?
Yeah, well, like, I think it's just a symptom of the overall neglect of mental health for decades and decades. I mean, you know, we thought it was a big step forward back in the 90s when you know, the government designed mental health services for the most acutely unwell, 3%. I mean, to me, you know, that just tells you how abysmal things are because, you know, what about the other 97%? And so inevitably what happened is a big chunk of that 97% have kept on knocking on that door and just overwhelmed children and young people's services, just like they've overwhelmed all mental health services. You know, this has been a very incredibly change-prone time for young people. I've got a 16-year-old, I've got a 21-year-old. The lives they've lived, you know, there are a lot of things that are the same as for me when I was their age, and there are a huge number of things that are fundamentally different. You know, the sorts of peer pressure that we all faced when we were younger, you know, gets turbocharged on social media. And it's not that social media is inherently evil, but it has that impact. It can turbocharge those things. It becomes a place where bullying can occur. You know, I remember when I was growing up, you know, we used to criticise, you know, the certain magazines for promoting sort of body image and all this kind of stuff. Well, now you've got it coming at you 24/7, you know, through different apps. Plus young people, you know, the world is an uncertain place. You know, if COVID-19 sort of has been a very extreme example of that, but you know, underneath all this, we've got climate change, you know, bubbling away and brewing away, and you know, the world is really going through some fundamental changes, and that is going to be putting, well, it is putting pressure on young people. So, again, you know, what we need to do is absolutely support those services. You know, the fact that they're that understaffed is horrendous, that people cannot get that support for young people when they need it, that young people can't get that support is absolutely horrendous. The government has supported some new initiatives like the Picky Youth Service pilot. Those things do take years to get off the ground. They have put money into things like mana ake in schools, and they've started to put, you know, the Ministry of Education has now started to focus more and more on well-being in schools. And again, it's that combination. You know, we need the reality is the world is what it is. You and I can't address the big issues that are impacting our children and young people today. We can be concerned about them and do what we can, but the world is what it is, and we need to equip our young people as much as possible with the skills, the support, the understandings that's going to help them to be as well as they possibly can. And yes, absolutely, we need to have the services there for them when they're really struggling.
Sean, let's finish with on a good note here if we can. Give us some cause for optimism.
Oh, look, I've got lots of cause for optimism. So, you know, we have a program called Sparklers that is a well-being exercise. It's a range of well-being activities that teachers can use in primary, intermediate, and they're even being used in high schools as well. And this is how it can work. This is one of my favourite stories. So a kid of about 8 was driving up down the highway with that program's in 86% of schools, by the way. Driving down the highway with their mother. Mother got cut off. Mother got really angry, started swearing. 8-year-old said, Mum, pull over. Now I want you to take 3 deep breaths into your belly and let them out really slowly. So, you know, if young people as young as 8 can be learning how to calm themselves down and actually then teaching that to their whānau, you know, that's the sort of transformational change that will make a huge difference going forward.
Mm. Yeah. Can't help but wonder how many parents could do with that kind of advice, whether it's come from their child or somebody else.
Oh, we all need that.
Aye, just take a breath, yeah.
Yeah, take 3 slow breaths. You know, a lot of the well-being things are very, very simple to do. It's just a matter of being reminded to do them and actually doing them.
Mm. There, you're so right. You're so right. Lovely story. Great little piece of advice too. Once again, Sean, thanks for chatting to us about how you're going, about how things are going out there. It's easy for us to sit here and probably paint quite a grim picture, but let's hope that as things get rolling with some of these other initiatives and some more investment, that perhaps, you know, 5 or 10 years down the track, we might be in a better place.
Yeah, look, absolutely. And I think, you know, all your listeners, we should all remember there's things we can do for ourselves and for each other. You know, when I was very unwell in my mid-30s, like I say, it was my friends that really made the difference. And they didn't even have to know what to say. You know, in fact, giving advice is the last thing I needed. Just being there and sitting with me. You know, just being in the same room is a hugely therapeutic thing to be around another human being who cares about you. So, yeah, there are so many things we can do for each other.
Sean Robinson, Chief Executive of the Mental Health Foundation, thank you so much for your time on Take It From Us today.
No problem.
just lay here, would you lie with me and just forget the world?
Take It From Us, that's what they call a mashup. That is Snow Patrol versus the Police. All right, let's talk about breathing. It's the most natural thing any of us can do. We need to breathe in order to survive. But how many of us are actually doing it wrong? And in terms of the kinds of life benefits, but particularly when it comes to reducing stress, anxiety, and lifting depression, what can we do to help ourselves with the most basic of human functions, that being to breathe? Well, joining us now on Take It From Us is Dina Seniza. She is from the Breathe Clinic in Auckland, and she's with us. Dina, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Ken.
Well, we wanted to talk today about breathing, and because it's natural, we all do it. Without doing it, we can't survive. Yet how many of us are not breathing properly, and because of that, we are actually not fulfilling our health needs, and particularly around our brains?
Mm-hmm. That's so true. I've been asked many times by, you know, people saying, why do I need a breathing coach, or why do I need to learn how to breathe? I've been breathing since I was born. That's very true, but not very many people realize that there's a right way to breathe and a wrong way to breathe. And the farther we are, so over time we develop poor breathing habits, and the farther we are from the right way of breathing, the farther we are from health as well. And whatever it is that we are prone to genetically, that is how the symptoms will come up. So it could be asthma, it could be high blood pressure, it could be mental health issues. Yeah, so it's different for everybody.
So what's the right or correct way that we should be breathing?
We should be breathing through the nose, in and out through the nose. Not very, a lot of people think they have to breathe out through the mouth. No, in and out through the nose. And it should be calm and gentle breathing. There are numerical values to the parameters, but normally in talks like this, I just give the description, because what people will be doing is, oh, I need to breathe this many times a minute. Oh, I should be. And then they start tweaking their breathing according to what they heard. But that's the wrong way to go about it, because then you're going to use your thinking brain. You're going to influence your breathing consciously when breathing should be automatic. So we don't want to be doing that, but we want to have a description of, you need to be breathing calmly and gently. And then if a person's not doing that, that's when they need to be helped. They need to be coached in how to normalize their breathing, how to get their breathing back on track.
So in times of stress, when we find ourselves stressed and anxious and worried, and at times we find ourselves worked up, what has happened to our breathing at that time?
It's a normal reaction to stress. So your breathing increases because you need more oxygen to your brain, you need oxygen to the different parts of your body, especially if you need to fight back or run away, you need oxygen to your muscles, you need sugar, glucose for you to do that, the energy. And so breathing goes faster, blood rushes to our brains faster as well. So all these things are compensatory mechanisms by the body. They're good. The problem begins when stress is prolonged. Then hyperventilation, or, you know, breathing too much, like as if you were stressed, becomes the norm. That is when your body is in constant stress. Then that becomes your habit. That becomes your norm. And your body thinks you're always in danger. That's where the problem lies, because your brain will be operating as if constantly in danger. So it triggers the stress response, and cortisol and adrenaline will be flooding your system.
Yeah. So we've taken inadvertently, we've gone from that fight or flight response, which is a short-term acute response, and we've turned it into a chronic problem.
Exactly. Yes, that's right. And because of that, there will be changes in your system, your metabolism, your blood chemistry. And one of the things, I wasn't sure whether we'd have enough time for this, but just to throw it out there, breathing, most people think of oxygen when we're talking about breathing, but actually what your brain monitors when it regulates your breathing is carbon dioxide, so CO2. And when you're under stress and you're breathing too much, your CO2 tolerance, your CO2 levels go down. We need CO2 in our bodies. We need to be tolerant to a certain level of CO2. And when we lose tolerance to CO2, then, then that's when all these things come. And one of the surprising roles of CO2 in relation to mental health is it calms the nervous system. When we have good levels of CO2, it helps calm your nervous system. So you've got better stress tolerance, you know, less anxiety and things like that. When your CO2 levels are low, your nervous system is hyperreactive, hypervigilant. And that's when anxiety predisposes you to anxiety and panic attacks and depression.
The science behind this is fascinating. The only way I can think that I know to increase the level of CO2 for me is if I hold my breath. So are you suggesting that in order to make the changes that we would need to, what, do we practice doing that, or are we breathing longer and slower? How do we do it?
You need to, number one, I'd say we can go, now these are the tips that I would say how to help your body, to encourage your body to retain the CO2 and get your CO2 tolerance higher, is to, number one, schedule relaxation in your day. Remember, breathing is automatic. So when you relax, your body responds by breathing calmer and gentler. So you want to do that. You don't want to tell your body, breathe slower or, you know, breathe smaller. No, because that's thinking about it, and you will dysregulate your breathing even more. So by relaxing, you're going the roundabout way to helping your breathing relax. And also breathing in and out through your nose. That will already help you stop losing CO2. When you're breathing through your mouth, you're breathing out a lot of CO2. Yeah? And so you're losing too much. When you're breathing through the nose has smaller holes, nostrils are smaller. So you're able to lessen the loss of CO2. And also to avoid taking big breaths. You know how when someone's anxious or, you know, in a state, people say, take a deep breath. But think about it. Deep, and what will they do? They'll take a big breath. Now, they're not synonyms. Deep is talking about depth. Big is talking about size. So they're words that are not synonyms. They're talking about different concepts. You can take a deep breath that's small. So never equate deep with big. You should be breathing calmly and gently, and avoiding losing more CO2. Now, if someone is in a anxious state or chronically anxious, then definitely their breathing is already dysregulated. And one of the things that they will need to attend to, of course, there are other things. There's talk therapy, there's all these other very good therapies, but one of the things that has been missed in the past years is to also help with breathing, because yes, the talk therapy can address certain things, and other modalities, CBT and all these other things, can address other issues. But your breathing has become a habit, so you're still breathing more, too much, you're hyperventilating. Even if the stressor is gone and the therapies are helping you, but if you're still breathing at this level, then your brain still thinks you're in danger. So physiologically, you're not getting out of the fight or flight because of that, because of the way you're breathing. So you may be understanding it intellectually through all these therapies, what's happened to you and how you're going to manage with it. But physiologically, your body thinks you're still in danger, and therefore you're not out of fight or flight. And I think it's a good thing to combine these things, just to make sure that, your body has the support in terms of the breathing.
How about one last question, Dina, if I may, on sleep. What about for those of us that breathe through our nose and maybe breathe out of our mouth when we're in bed, and particularly those people that, say, go to sleep on their stomachs, and so breathing doesn't come as easily? What can we do to help that?
You'll be surprised. Dr. Buteyko, who's a proponent, who started the Buteyko method, he actually said that sleeping on your belly is the best position for sleep, because
really
Yeah, except that the thing with the problem with that is anatomically your neck, you might have stiff neck and things like that. But in terms of breathing, that was a better way to breathe because it gets your breathing back down to calm and gentle. The best way to sleep, the second best way would be on your left side because that's the other position with the lower breathing. Now, when you open your mouth in bed, what that means is during the day you've been hyperventilating. But maybe during the day you might have your own way of regulating yourself because you go, it's funny if I have my mouth hanging open. So you won't allow yourself to have your mouth hanging open all the time during the day. When you go to sleep, the way you were breathing during the day will be the way you will breathe at night and even worse because now you're asleep, no more conscious thinking. So now your mouth will pop open. There's no mind to say, don't do that. It's weird or funny or whatever. So your breathing will be affected by that.
So we can finish. We can finish on a really optimistic note, then, or positive note, that if we were to concentrate and to take care of our breathing during the day, and to breathe in through our nose, out through our nose during the day, when we're asleep, the chances of being successful with that breathing technique have been greatly elevated.
It would be one thing is because it is a process. What Buteyko tries to do is get your breathing. You know how I said about breathing habits going off track? We're trying to get your automatic day-to-day breathing back on track so that you don't have to think about it. Because when you think about it during the day, that's actually not the program in your mind. So when you go to sleep, it's still your brain is still going to do whatever it's programmed to do, which might be hyperventilating. So if you find yourself doing that, that's the time to go, let's look into my breathing. Maybe I do need help in getting my breathing back on track and so that you sleeping better because you're not on fight or flight. Your brain will allow you to sleep deeper because you're not in danger. And your good breathing is now your back door to your autonomic nervous system and therefore regulates it and helps you to be calmer and more relaxed.
Tell me how I'm supposed to breathe with no air. If I should die before I wake, it's 'cause you took my breath away. Losing you is like living in a world with no air. Oh. deep. Tell me how you're gonna be without me. If you ain't here, I just can't breathe. There's no air, no air.
That is Jordan Sparks on Take It From Us. The song is called No Air. Well, we spoke with Angela Smart recently on the program. She's from moneytalks.co.nz, and we thought it was timely just to hear her advice again when it comes to sort of finances and budgeting. So there's a lot of stress, a lot of worry at the moment, and we wanted to know what is the number one driver as far as that stress and anxiety that we have been feeling when it comes to money.
The number one is just there's just not enough money to go around. There's just too many competing expenses and conversations around, you know, what was a manageable bill or a manageable expense, you know, only 6 months ago is now no longer. And it's not like people are getting wage rises of 6 or 7% in line with inflation. So, yeah, there's some real stresses on family and just individual budgets at the moment.
End of the financial year too, does that factor in for the average person on the street, or are we really talking about businesses there?
That would be mainly for businesses. What will be interesting is to see whether people have been taxed correctly, and I really hope that there aren't any conversations about surprise tax bills at the end of the financial year, because, you know, that all gets calculated just in the background of IRD's website. And so hopefully everybody's being taxed correctly if you're on PAYE. Otherwise, you could end up with a tax bill. But my suggestion there would be to go onto the IRD website and you log in under My IR. And if you haven't got a login, go and get one. It is the most simplest process to do, and it gives you all your information as to what you do or don't owe the IRD, because, mate, that's the last thing anyone needs is a tax bill. But if that is you, have a chat to IRD. Talk to them. Don't wait until they come chasing you, because you don't need to pay interest or penalties.
And you mentioned there's not enough money to go around. I mean, where do we start? Food, petrol, mortgages, interest rates, wanting to save for a holiday, because a lot of us probably need one and we're not sure if we've got enough or can justify having a holiday. What are people sacrifice? What are the people that you work with having to sacrifice at the moment to just keep their heads above water?
The worst part is usually it's food. And how many parents go without food in their tummies because they want to make sure that the kids are fed? You know, things like power bills or the phone bill or the rent or the mortgage or insurance, those are kind of fixed expenses every single week, every single month. So it's always food that ends up getting pushed down the list, and whatever is left is then what is left to actually go to the grocery store. So in those kind of conversations, I'd really look and encourage, get on that WINS website and make sure that there aren't any other entitlements that you are, you know, that are available to you. You know, whether you've got, if you've got a kid with a disability, whether it be a neurological or a physical, you've got entitlements under the Child Disability Allowance. And, you know, that might be something that you've never thought about, but it's not even income tested. So there could be lots of other options out there, you know, that you could actually be entitled to from an income perspective. But from the expense perspective, budget, ring around, get different quotes, especially for insurances, making sure that you're still covered. But, man, everyone is hurting. And that's pretty much the end of it at the moment, is that it's not escaping anyone.
Yeah, we're all in this together, aren't we? We really are.
And there is something about that too.
Sure.
Is that we can look at our neighbour and go, man, this sucks. Man, this is hurting. Yeah, you're hurting too. You know, and it's a little bit of a all in pain together.
Well, the empathy goes a long way.
It does. It absolutely does. Because, you know, are you more likely to then go and help your neighbour? Are you more likely to go, oh, hey, actually, I got given this extra bag of meat or extra bag of fruit. Can I go and give this to you? Can I, you know, encourage that kind of behaviour as well?
I'm glad you mentioned the word budget. Where do people go wrong when they're budgeting?
We like to think we're a lot better at saving and not spending as much as what we actually do. oh, no, I'm sure I only spend $10 a week, you know, at the local dairy. And then you realize it's $20 a week. And you kind of extrapolate that out across the board. And we really, really suck at actually estimating what it is that we spend. So that's probably the best thing is actually go back the last 4 weeks of your bank statements and go and categorize it, go and have a good look at it and actually see what you do spend, not what you think you spend, but what you actually do spend.
And so 4 weeks, is that because that's a big enough sample size to give us kind of like a rolling average as to how our spending behaviour is going?
Yeah, and it's in line, you know, because you pay your power bill once a month kind of thing, you know, like those kind of monthly bills, and it kind of encapsulates the whole thing and actually see what is coming in from an income perspective, what's actually going out from an expense perspective, and then have a look and see, you know, do you have that gap? Do you have that nice, beautiful disposable income gap? So that's the money in between what you're getting in and what's going out. That's what you're left with. And if that is a negative, not a positive, then it's either earn more income or reduce your expenses.
You got me thinking now, Ange. If I was to go back and look at my last month's worth of spending, X number of dollars at the supermarket, then you throw on the odd takeaway, you throw on going to the fruit shop or the butchery, all of those separate spends, and that's just food-related.
And you know what? I'd say
food. I bet you I've spent more than I thought.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. You know what? And I'd be one of the first to encourage online grocery shopping. Once a week, do it in line with your payday. You can actually, like with Pack and Save, you can actually already go ahead a week in advance, create your shopping bill, and they don't even take the money out until the day that you go to pick up your grocery. So if you know you get paid on a Wednesday, on Monday, already go in, set up a time slot for the Thursday so that your groceries are already set, sorted and done for the whole week. You know the money's in the account. You're good and sorted. Pack and Save don't take it out until that day. And therefore, you are watching what is going inside that shopping basket. Because, mate, if you take kids with you, you're going to end up buying stuff that you don't need. But you're far less likely to get to the you know, get to the till and be like, oh, man, I've spent $50 too much, then I can't. And you're too embarrassed to go and put something back. But pay that $5 for the delivery fee or the whatever fee, because it will save you in the long run.
That's a tremendous piece of advice. For those of us listening whose heads are swimming in fear and anxiety and worry, and we just don't know where to start, and making a start seems like hard work, what would be your best piece of advice?
Start with one small thing. Start with one bill that you think is a manageable thing. So whether, you know, I wonder on those days when you're like, oh, I've got that bill, or it's coming in the mail, or it's gone into my email box, and it's just too overwhelming to open. It's too big to pick up. The conversation is, just open one of those. Open up one envelope and then go and have a chat to someone. Because that's, as Kiwis, we are really bad about talking about money. We are so petrified of what it means. We've been taught that it's a shameful thing to ask for help. And, you know, we don't even talk about what we get paid. We certainly don't talk about, you know, what our mortgage is. We don't, because there's just layers of complexity there. So, you know, one of the best things you can do is that if it is feeling too big, you can reach out to Money Talks, and what we can do is put you in contact with a financial mentor. And you don't have to go to an office if right now outside's feeling a bit scary and a bit overwhelming. You've actually got the ability to catch up with a financial mentor who will look at your entire situation, reorganize any debts that you've got, renegotiate them, push back on them, make sure that they were even responsibly given. And they can do it all by phone. You don't even have to go anywhere for it.
Yes, yeah, some really good financial advice there from Angela Smart. You can follow her on moneytalks.co.nz. That is almost our program for another week. As we always do, though, we wrap it up with some positivity and some optimism and some good news. And that is our Sheldon shout-out of the week. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Kent. Well, I got a message this week from a lady who just wanted to be known as C, and she actually wanted to send us a message to say she wanted to give a shout-out to her sister, T. She's been worried about T for a while because she's recognised T had been having some anxiety and what she thought maybe was depression. So she said that T has finally taken some steps to speak to a professional and get some advice on how to help herself get a bit better. So C's very happy with that. So shout out to T for taking the first steps to get some help to get well.
Great. Well done, T. And great that C has the support, has been giving the support. And that's a really lovely story. Thanks very much for passing that one on, Karen. That is our program for another week on Take It From Us. Thanks to Karen Murphy for producing the program. Thanks to all of our guests, as always, to Sean Robinson and Dina Sinisa for being with us and for giving us some really good advice and just giving us their thoughts on how things are going in this great little country of ours. We hope you have a great week. Take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. We'll talk again next week here on Take It From Us.
You've been listening to Take It From Us with host Kent Johns, produced by Karen Murphy, executive producer Andrew Dewhurst, made with the real stories and voices from our community. And for that, we thank you. For more information on anything you've heard on today's show, or for direction on where to seek further advice or assistance, visit our Facebook page, Take It From Us.